marveled. The harmony of these astral tables did not prevent the incessant revolution of the countless servants, who, because instead of being seated like the diners, they were on their feet, performed their evolutions in a more exalted sphere. No doubt they were running, one to fetch the hors d'oeuvre, another to change the wine or with clean glasses, but despite these special reasons, their perpetual course among the round tables yielded after a time to the observer the law of its dizzy but ordered circulation. Seated behind a bank of flowers, two horrible cashiers, busy with endless calculations, seemed two witches occupied in forecasting by astrological signs the disasters that might from time to time occur in this celestial vault fashioned according to the scientific conceptions of the Middle Ages. And I rather pitied all the diners, because I felt that for them the round tables were not planets, and that they had not cut through the scheme of things one of those sections which deliver us from the bondage of appearances and enable us to perceive analogies. They thought that they were dining with this or that person, that the dinner would cost roughly so much, and that tomorrow they would begin all over again. And they appeared absolutely unmoved by the progress through their midst of a train of young assistants who, having probably at that moment no urgent duty, advanced processionally bearing rolls of bread in baskets. Some of them, the youngest, stunned by the cuffs which the head waiters administered to them as they passed, fixed melancholy eyes upon a distant dream, and were consoled only if some visitor from the Baalbek Hotel in which they had once been employed, recognizing them, said a few words to them, telling them in person to take away the champagne which was not fit to drink, an order that filled them with pride. I could hear the twinging of my nerves, in which there was a sense of comfort, independent of the external objects that might have produced it, a comfort which the least shifting of my body or of my attention was enough to make me feel, just as to a shut eye a slight pressure gives the sensation of colour. I had already drunk a good deal of port wine, and if I now asked for more, it was not so much with a view to the comfort which the additional glasses would bring me, as an effect of the comfort produced by the glasses that had gone before. I allowed the music itself to guide to each of its notes my pleasure, which, meekly following, rested on each in turn. If, like one of those chemical industries, by means of which are prepared in large quantities bodies which in a state of nature come together only by accident and very rarely, this restaurant at Rivebelle united at one and the same moment more women to tempt me with beckoning vistas of happiness than the hazard of walks and drives would have made me encounter in a year. On the other hand, this music that greeted our ears, arrangements of waltzes, of German operettas, of music hall songs, all of them quite new to me, was itself like an ethereal resort of pleasure superimposed upon the other, and more intoxicating still. For these tunes, each as individual as a woman, were not keeping as she would have kept for some privileged person the voluptuous secret which they contained. They offered me their secrets, ogled me, came up to me with affected or vulgar movements, accosted me, caressed me as if I had suddenly become more seductive, more powerful, and more rich. I, indeed, found in these tunes an element of cruelty, because any such thing as a disinterested feeling for beauty, a gleam of intelligence, was unknown to them. For them, physical pleasures alone existed. And they are the most merciless of hells, the most gateless and imprisoning for the jealous wretch to whom they present that pleasure which the woman he loves is enjoying with another, as the only thing that exists in the world for her who is all the world to him. But while I was humming softly to myself the notes of this tune and returning its kiss, the pleasure peculiar to itself which it made me feel became so dear to me that I would have left my father and mother to follow it through the singular world which it constructed in the invisible, in lines instinct with alternate languor and vivacity. Although such a pleasure as this is not calculated to enhance the value of the person to whom it comes, for it is perceived by him alone, and although, whenever in the course of our life, we have failed to attract a woman who has caught sight of us, she could not tell whether at that moment we possessed this inward and subjective felicity, which, consequently, could in no way have altered the judgment that she passed on us, I felt myself more powerful, almost irresistible. It seemed to me that my love was no longer something unattractive at which people might smile, but had precisely the touching beauty, the seductiveness of this music, itself comparable to a friendly atmosphere in which she whom I loved and I were to meet suddenly grown intimate. This restaurant was the resort not only of light women. It was frequented also by people in the very best society, who came there for afternoon tea or gave big dinner parties. The tea parties were held in a long gallery, glazed and narrow, shaped like a funnel, which led from the entrance hall to the dining room, and was bounded on one side by the garden, from which it was separated, save for a few stone pillars, only by its wall of glass, in which panes would be opened here and there. The result of which, apart from ubiquitous draughts, was sudden and intermittent bursts of sunshine, a dazzling light that made it almost impossible to see the tea drinkers, so that when they were installed there at tables crowded pair after pair the whole way along the narrow gully, as they were shot with colours at every movement they made in drinking their tea or in greeting one another, you would have called it a reservoir, a stew-pond, in which the fisherman has collected all his glittering catch, and the fish, half out of water and bathed in sunlight, dazzle the eye as they mirror an ever-changing iridescence. A few hours later, during dinner, which naturally was served in the dining room, the lights would be turned on, although it was still quite light out of doors, so that one saw before one's eyes in the garden, among summer houses glimmering in the twilight like pale spectres of evening, alleys whose greyish verdure was pierced by the last rays of the setting sun, and from the lamp-lit room in which we were dining appeared through the glass, no longer, as one would have said of the ladies who had been drinking tea there in the afternoon, along the blue and gold corridor, caught in a glittering and dripping net, but like the vegetation of a pale and green aquarium of gigantic size, seen by a supernatural light. People began to rise from the table. And if each party, while their dinner lasted, albeit they spent the whole time examining, recognizing, naming the party at the next table, had been held in perfect cohesion about their own, the attractive force that had kept them gravitating round their host of the evening lost its power at the moment when, for coffee, they repaired to the same corridor that had been used for the tea parties. It often happened that in this passage from place to place, some party on the march dropped one or more of its human corpuscles who, having come under the irresistible attraction of the rival party, detached themselves for a moment from their own, in which their places were taken by ladies or gentlemen who had come across to speak to friends before hurrying off with a, "I really must fly. I'm dining with Monsieur So-and-so." And for the moment you would have been reminded, looking at them, of two separate nosegays that had exchanged a few of their flowers. Then the corridor, too, began to empty. Often, since even after dinner there was still a little light left outside, they left this long corridor unlighted, and skirted by the trees that overhung it on the other side of the glass, it suggested a pleached alley in a wooded and shady garden. Here and there, in the gloom, a fair diner lingered. As I passed through this corridor one evening on my way out, I saw sitting among a group of strangers the beautiful Princesse de Luxembourg. I raised my hat without stopping. She remembered me and bowed her head with a smile. In the air, far above her bowed head, but emanating from the movement, rose melodiously a few words addressed to myself, which must have been a somewhat amplified good evening, intended not to stop me, but simply to complete the gesture, to make it a spoken greeting. But her words remained so indistinct, and the sound, which was all that I caught, was prolonged so sweetly and seemed to me so musical that it seemed as if among the dim branches of the trees a nightingale had begun to sing. If it so happened that to finish the evening with a party of his friends whom we had met, Saint-Loup decided to go on to the casino of a neighbouring village, and taking them with him, put me in a carriage by myself, I would urge the driver to go as fast as he possibly could, so that the minutes might pass less slowly, which I must spend without having anyone at hand to dispense me from the obligation myself to provide my sensibility, reversing the engine, so to speak, and emerging from the passivity in which I was caught and held, as in the teeth of a machine, with those modifications which, since my arrival at Rivebel, I had been receiving from other people. The risk of collision with a carriage coming the other way along those lanes, where there was barely room for one and it was dark as pitch, the insecurity of the soil crumbling in many places at the cliff's edge, the proximity of its vertical drop to the sea, none of these things exerted on me the slight stimulus that would have been required to bring the vision and the fear of danger within the scope of my reasoning. For just as it is not the desire to become famous, but the habit of being laborious that enables us to produce a finished work, so it is not the activity of the present moment, but wise reflections from the past that help us to safeguard the future. But if already, before this point, on my arrival at Rivebel, I had flung irretrievably away from me those crutches of reason and self-control which help our infirmity to follow the right road, if I now found myself the victim of a sort of moral ataxy, the alcohol that I had drunk by unduly straining my nerves gave to the minutes as they came a quality, a charm, which did not have the result of leaving me more ready or indeed more resolute to inhibit them, prevent their coming. For while it made me prefer them 1,000 times to anything else in my life, my exaltation made me isolate them from everything else. I was confined to the present, as heroes are, or drunkards. Eclipsed for the moment, my past no longer projected before me that shadow of itself which we call our future, placing the goal of my life no longer in the realization of the dreams of that past, but in the felicity of the present moment, I could see nothing now of what lay beyond it. So that, by a contradiction which, however, was only apparent, it was at the very moment in which I was tasting an unfamiliar pleasure, feeling that my life might yet be happy, in which it should have become more precious in my sight. It was at this very moment that, delivered from the anxieties which my life had hitherto contrived to suggest to me, I unhesitatingly abandoned it to the chance of an accident. After all, I was doing no more than concentrate in a single evening the carelessness that for most men is diluted throughout their whole existence, in which every day they face unnecessarily the dangers of a sea voyage, of a trip in an aeroplane or motor car, when there is waiting for them at home the creature whose life their death would shatter, or when there is still stored in the fragile receptacle of their brain that book the approaching publication of which is their one object now in life. And so, too, in the Rivebel restaurant, on evenings when we just stayed there after dinner, if anyone had come in with the intention of killing me, as I no longer saw, save in a distant prospect too remote to have any reality, my grandmother, my life to come, the books that I was going to write, as I clung now, body and mind, wholly to the scent of the lady at the next table, the politeness of the waiters, the outline of the waltz that the band was playing, as I was glued to my immediate sensation, with no extension beyond its limits, nor any object other than not to be separated from it, I should have died in and with that sensation. I should have let myself be strangled without offering any resistance, without a movement, a bee drugged with tobacco smoke that had ceased to take any thought for preserving the accumulation of its labours and the hopes of its hive. I ought here to add that this insignificance into which the most serious matters subsided, by contrast with the violence of my exultation, came in the end to include Mademoiselle Simonet and her friends. The enterprise of knowing them seemed to me easy now, but hardly worth the trouble, for my immediate sensation alone, thanks to its extraordinary intensity, to the joy that its slightest modifications, its mere continuity provoked, had any importance for me. All the rest, parents, work, pleasures, girls at Baalbek, weighed with me no more than does a flake of foam in a strong wind that will not let it find a resting place, existing no longer save in relation to this internal power. Intoxication makes real for an hour or two a subjective idealism, pure phenomenism. Nothing is left now but appearances. Nothing exists save as a function of our sublime self. This is not to say that a genuine love, if we have one, cannot survive in such conditions, but we feel so unmistakably, as though in a new atmosphere, that unknown pressures have altered the dimensions of that sentiment, that we can no longer consider it in the old way. It is indeed still there, and we shall find it, but in a different place. No longer weighing upon us, satisfied by the sensation which the present affords it, a sensation that is sufficient for us, since for what is not actually present we take no thought. Unfortunately, the coefficient which thus alters our values alters them only in the hour of intoxication. The people who had lost all their importance, whom we scattered with our breath like soap bubbles, will tomorrow resume their density. We shall have to try afresh to settle down to work, which this evening had ceased to have any significance. A more serious matter still, these mathematics of the morrow, the same as those of yesterday in whose problems we shall find ourselves inexorably involved, it is they that govern us even in these hours, and we alone are unconscious of their rule. If there should happen to be near us a woman, virtuous or inimical, that question so difficult an hour ago, to know whether we should succeed in finding favour with her, seems to us now a million times easier of solution without having become easier in any respect, for it is only in our own sight, in our own inward sight, that we have altered. And she is as much annoyed with us at this moment as we shall be next day at the thought of our having given 100 francs to the messenger, and for the same reason which in our case has merely been delayed in its operation, namely, the absence of intoxication. I knew none of the women who were at Rivebelle, and because they formed a part of my intoxication, just as its reflections form part of a mirror, appeared to me now 1,000 times more to be desired than the less and less existent Mademoiselle Simonet. One of them, young, fair, by herself, with a sad expression on a face framed in a straw hat trimmed with field flowers, gazed at me for a moment with a dreamy air, and struck me as being attractive. Then it was the turn of another, and of a third, finally of a dark one with glowing cheeks. Almost all of them were known, if not to myself, to Saint-Loup. He had, in fact, before he made the acquaintance of his present mistress, lived so much in the restricted world of amorous adventure that all the women who would be dining on these evenings at Rivebelle, where many of them had appeared quite by chance, having come to the coast some to join their lovers, others in the hope of finding fresh lovers there, there was scarcely one that he did not know from having spent, or if not he, one or other of his friends, at least one night in their company. He did not bow to them if they were with men, and they, albeit they looked more at him than at anyone else, for the indifference which he was known to feel towards every woman who was not his mistress, gave him in their eyes an exceptional interest, appeared not to know him. But you could hear them whispering, "That's young Saint-Loup. It seems he's still quite gone on that girl of his. Got it bad, he has. What a dear boy. I think he's just wonderful. And what style. Some girls do have all the luck, don't they? And he's so nice in every way. I saw a lot of him when I was with D'Orléans. They were quite inseparable, those two. He was going the pace that time. But he's given it all up now. She can't complain. She's had a run of good luck, that she can say. And I ask you, what in the world can he see in her? He must be a bit of a chump when all's said and done. She's got feet like boats, whiskers like an American, and her undies are filthy. I can tell you, a little shop girl would be ashamed to be seen in her knickers. Do just look at his eyes a moment. You would jump into the fire for a man like that. Hush! Don't say a word. He's seen me. Look, he's smiling. Oh, he remembers me all right. Just you mention my name to him and see what he says." Between these girls and him, I surprised a glance of mutual understanding. I should have liked him to introduce me to them, so that I might ask them for assignations and they give them to me, even if I had been unable to keep them. For otherwise their appearance would remain for all time devoid in my memory of that part of itself, just as though it had been hidden by a veil which varies in every woman, which we cannot imagine in any woman until we have actually seen it in her, and which is apparent only in the glance that she directs at us, that acquiesces in our desire, and promises that it shall be satisfied. And yet, even when thus reduced, their aspect was for me far more than that of women whom I should have known to be virtuous, and it seemed to me not to be like theirs, flat with nothing behind it, fashioned in one piece with no solidity. It was not, of course, for me what it must be for Saint-Loup, who, by an act of memory, beneath the indifference, transparent to him, of the motionless features which affected not to know him, or beneath the dull formality of the greeting that might equally well have been addressed to anyone else, could recall, could see through dishevelled locks, a swooning mouth, a pair of half-closed eyes, a whole silent picture like those that painters, to cheat their visitors' senses, drape with a decent covering. Undoubtedly, for me, who felt that nothing of my personality had penetrated the surface of this woman or that, or would be borne by her upon the unknown ways which she would tread through life, those faces remained sealed. But it was quite enough to know that they did open, for them to seem to me of a price which I should not have set on them, had they been but precious metals, instead of lockets within which were hidden memories of love. As for Robert, scarcely able to keep in his place at table, concealing beneath a courtier's smile his warrior's thirst for action, when I examined him, I could see how closely the vigorous structure of his triangular face must have been modelled on that of his ancestors' faces, a face devised rather for an ardent bowman than for a delicate student. Beneath his fine skin, the bold construction, the feudal architecture were apparent. His head made one think of those old dungeon keeps on which the disused battlements are still to be seen, although inside they have been converted into libraries. On our way back to Baalbek, of those of the fair strangers to whom he had introduced me, I would repeat to myself without a moment's interruption and yet almost unconsciously, "What a delightful woman!" as one chimes in with the refrain of a song. I admit that these words were prompted rather by the state of my nerves than by any lasting judgment. It was nevertheless true that if I had had 1,000 francs on me, and if there had still been a jeweller's shop open at that hour, I should have bought the lady a ring. When the successive hours of our life are thus displayed against two widely dissimilar backgrounds, we find that we give away too much of ourselves to all sorts of people who next day will not interest us in the least. But we feel that we are still responsible for what we said to them overnight, and that we must honour our promises. As on these evenings I came back later than usual to the hotel, it was with joy that I recognised in a room no longer hostile the bed on which, on the day of my arrival, I had supposed that it would always be impossible for me to find any rest, whereas now my weary limbs turned to it for support, so that in turn thighs, hips, shoulders burrowed into, trying to adhere at every angle to, the sheets that covered its mattress, as if my fatigue, like a sculptor, had wished to take a cast of an entire human body. But I could not go to sleep. I felt the approach of morning. Peace of mind, health of body, were no longer mine. In my distress it seemed that never should I recapture them. I should have had to sleep for a long time if I were to overtake them. But then, had I begun to doze, I must in any event be awakened in a couple of hours by the symphonic concert on the beach. Suddenly, I was asleep. I had fallen into that deep slumber in which are opened to us a return to childhood, the recapture of past years, of lost feelings, the disincarnation, the transmigration of the soul, the evoking of the dead, the illusions of madness, retrogression towards the most elementary of the natural kingdoms. For we say that we often see animals in our dreams, but we forget almost always that we are ourselves then an animal, deprived of that reasoning power which projects upon things the light of certainty. We present, on the contrary, to the spectacle of life only a dubious vision, destroyed afresh every moment by oblivion, the former reality fading before that which follows it, as one projection of a magic lantern fades before the next as we change the slide. All those mysteries which we imagine ourselves not to know, and into which we are in reality initiated almost every night, as we are into the other great mystery of annihilation and resurrection. Rendered more vagabond by the difficulty of digesting my Rivebel dinner, the successive and flickering illumination of shadowy zones of my past made of me a being whose supreme happiness would have been that of meeting Le Grandin, with whom I had just been talking in my dream. And then, even my own life was entirely hidden from me by a new setting, like the drop lowered right at the front of the stage before which, while the scene shifters are busy behind, actors appear in a fresh turn. The turn in which I was now cast for a part was in the manner of an Oriental fairy tale. I retained no knowledge of my past or of myself on account of the intense proximity of this interpolated scenery. I was merely a person who received the bastinado and underwent various punishments for a crime the nature of which I could not distinguish, though it was actually that of having taken too much port wine. Suddenly I awoke and discovered that, thanks to a long sleep, I had not heard a note of the concert. It was already afternoon. I verified this by my watch after several efforts to sit up in bed, efforts fruitless at first, and interrupted by backward falls onto my pillow, but those short falls which are a sequel of sleep, as of other forms of intoxication, whether due to wine or to convalescence. Besides, before I had so much as looked at the time, I was certain that it was past midday. Last night I had been nothing more than an empty vessel without weight, and since I must first have gone to bed to be able to keep still, and have been asleep to be able to keep silent, had been unable to refrain from moving about and talking. I had no longer any stability, any centre of gravity. I was set in motion, and it seemed that I might have continued on my dreary course until I reached the moon. But if, while I slept, my eyes had not seen the time, my body had nevertheless contrived to calculate it, had measured the hours, not on a dial superficially marked and figured, but by the steadily growing weight of all my replenished forces, which, like a powerful clockwork, it had allowed notch by notch to descend from my brain into the rest of my body, in which there had risen now to above my knees the unbroken abundance of their store. If it is true that the sea was once upon a time our native element, into which we must plunge our cooling blood if we are to recover our strength, it is the same with the oblivion, the mental non-existence of sleep. We seem then to absent ourselves for a few hours from time, but the forces which we've gathered in that interval without expending them measure it by their quantity as accurately as the pendulum of the clock or the crumbling pyramid of the sandglass. Nor does one emerge more easily from such sleep than from a prolonged spell of wakefulness, so strongly does everything tend to persist. And if it is true that certain narcotics make us sleep, to have slept for any time is an even stronger narcotic, after which we have great difficulty in making ourselves wake up. Like a sailor who sees plainly the harbour in which he can moor his vessel, still tossed by the waves, I had a quite definite idea of looking at the time and of getting up, but my body was at every moment cast back upon the tide of sleep. The landing was difficult, and before I attained a position in which I could reach my watch and confront with its time, that indicated by the wealth of accumulated material which my stiffened limbs had at their disposal, I fell back two or three times more upon my pillow. At length I could reach and read it. 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I rang, but at once I returned to a slumber which this time must have lasted infinitely longer, if I was to judge by the refreshment, the vision of an immense night overpast, which I found on awakening. And yet, as my awakening was caused by the entry of Françoise, and as her entry had been prompted by my ringing the bell, this second sleep, which it seemed to me must have been longer than the other, and had brought me so much comfort and forgetfulness, could not have lasted for more than half a minute. My grandmother opened the door of my bedroom. I asked her various questions about the Le Grandin family. It is not enough to say that I had returned to tranquillity and health, for it was more than a mere interval of space that had divided them from me yesterday. I had had all night long to struggle against a contrary tide, and now I not only found myself again in their presence, they had once more entered into me. At certain definite and still somewhat painful points beneath the surface of my empty head, which would one day be broken, letting my ideas escape for all time, those ideas had once again taken their proper places and resumed that existence by which hitherto, alas, they had failed to profit. Once again I had escaped from the impossibility of sleeping, from the deluge, the shipwreck of my nervous storms. I feared now not at all the menaces that had loomed over me the evening before, when I was dismantled of repose. A new life was opening before me. Without making a single movement, for I was still shattered, although quite alert and well, I savoured my weariness with a light heart. It had isolated and broken asunder the bones of my legs and arms, which I could feel assembled before me, ready to cleave together, and which I was to raise to life merely by singing, like the builder in the fable. Suddenly I thought of the fair girl with the sad expression whom I had seen at Rivebelle, where she had looked at me for a moment. Many others in the course of the evening had seemed to me attractive. Now she alone arose from the dark places of my memory. I had felt that she noticed me, had expected one of the waiters to come to me with a whispered message from her. Salu did not know her and fancied that she was respectable. It would be very difficult to see her constantly, but I was prepared to make any sacrifice. I thought now only of her. Philosophy distinguishes often between free and necessary acts. Perhaps there is none to the necessity of which we are more completely subjected than that which, by virtue of an ascending power held in check during the act itself, makes so unfailingly, once our mind is at rest, spring up a memory that was levelled with other memories by the distributed pressure of our indifference, and rush to the surface, because, unknown to us, it contained more than any of the others, a charm of which we do not become aware until the following day. And perhaps there is not, either, any act so free, for it is still unprompted by habit, by that sort of mental hallucination which, when we are in love, facilitates the invariable reappearance of the image of one particular person. This was the day immediately following that on which I had seen file past me, against a background of sea, the beautiful procession of young girls. I put questions about them to a number of the visitors in the hotel, people who came almost every year to Baalbek. They could tell me nothing. Later on, a photograph showed me why. Who could ever recognize now in them, scarcely and yet quite definitely beyond an age in which one changes so utterly, that amorphous, delicious mass, still wholly infantine, of little girls who, only a few years back, might have been seen sitting in a ring on the sand round a tent, a sort of white and vague constellation in which one would have distinguished a pair of eyes that sparkled more than the rest, a mischievous face, flaxen hair, only to lose them again, and to confound them almost at once in the indistinct and milky nebula. No doubt in those earlier years that were still so recent, it was not as it had been yesterday when they appeared for the first time before me, one's impression of the group, but the group itself that had been lacking in clearness. Then those children, mere babies, had been still at that elementary stage in their formation when personality has not set its seal on every face. Like those primitive organisms in which the individual barely exists by itself, consists in the reef rather than in the coral insects that compose it, they were still pressed one against another. Sometimes one pushed her neighbour over, then a wild laugh, which seemed the sole manifestation of their personal life, convulsed them all at once, obliterating, confounding those indefinite grinning faces in the congealment of a single cluster, scintillating and tremulous. In an old photograph of themselves, which they were one day to give me, and which I have kept ever since, their infantile troop already presents the same number of participants as, later, their feminine procession. One can see from it that their presence must, even then, have made on the beach an unusual mark, which forced itself on the attention. But one cannot recognize them individually in it, save by a process of reasoning, leaving a clear field to all the transformations possible during girlhood, up to the point at which one reconstructed form would begin to encroach upon another individuality, which must be identified also, and whose handsome face, owing to the accessories of a large build and curly hair, may quite possibly have been once that wizened and impish little grin which the photograph album presents to us. And the distance traversed in a short interval of time by the physical characteristics of each of these girls, making of them a criterion too vague to be of any use, whereas what they had in common and, so to speak, collectively, had at that early date been strongly marked. It sometimes happened that even their most intimate friends mistook one for another in this photograph, so much so that the question could in the last resort be settled only by some detail of costume, which one of them could be certain that she herself and not any of the others had worn. Since those days, so different from the day on which I had just seen them strolling along the front, so different and yet so close in time, they still gave way to fits of laughter, as I had observed that afternoon, but to laughter of a kind that was no longer the intermittent and almost automatic laughter of childhood, a spasmodic discharge which, in those days, had continually sent their heads dipping out of the circle, as the clusters of minnows in the Vivonne used to scatter and vanish, only to gather again a moment later. Each countenance was now mistress of itself. Their eyes were fixed on the goal towards which they were marching, and it had taken yesterday the indecision and tremulousness of my first impression to make me confuse vaguely, as their childish hilarity and the old photograph had confused, the spores now individualized and disjoined of the pale madrepore. Repeatedly, I dare say, when pretty girls went by, I had promised myself that I would see them again. As a rule, people do not appear a second time. Moreover, our memory, which speedily forgets their existence, would find it difficult to recall their appearance. Our eyes would not recognize them, perhaps, and in the meantime we have seen new girls go by, whom we shall not see again either. But at other times, and this was what was to happen with the pert little band at Baalbek, chance brings them back insistently before our eyes. Chance seems to us, then, a good and useful thing, for we discern in it, as it were, rudiments of organization, of an attempt to arrange our life. And it makes easy to us, inevitable, and sometimes, after interruptions that have made us hope that we may cease to remember, cruel. The retention in our minds of images to the possession of which we shall come in time to believe that we were predestined, and which, but for chance, we should from the very first have managed to forget, like so many others, with so little difficulty. Presently, Saint-Loup's visit drew to an end. I had not seen that party of girls again on the beach. He was too little at Baalbek in the afternoons to have time to bother about them, or to attempt in my interest to make their acquaintance. In the evenings he was more free and continued to take me constantly to Rivebelle. There are in those restaurants, as there are in public gardens and railway trains, people embodied in a quite ordinary appearance, whose name astonishes us when, having happened to ask it, we discover that this is not the mere inoffensive stranger whom we supposed, but nothing less than the minister or duke of whom we have so often heard. Two or three times already in the Rivebelle restaurant, we had, Saint-Loup and I, seen come in and sit down at a table when everyone else was getting ready to go, a man of large stature, very muscular, with regular features and a grizzled beard, gazing with concentrated attention into the empty air. One evening, on our asking the landlord who was this obscure, solitary, and belated diner, "What?" he exclaimed. "Do you mean to say you don't know the famous painter, Elstir?" Swann had once mentioned his name to me. I had entirely forgotten in what connection, but the omission of a particular memory, like that of part of a sentence when we're reading, leads sometimes not to uncertainty, but to a birth of certainty that is premature. "He is a friend of Swann, a very well-known artist, extremely good," I told Saint-Loup. Whereupon there passed over us both, like a wave of emotion, the thought that Elstir was a great artist, a celebrated man, and that, confounding us with the rest of the diners, he had no suspicion of the ecstasy into which we were thrown by the idea of his talent. Doubtless his unconsciousness of our admiration and of our acquaintance with Swann would not have troubled us had we not been at the seaside. But since we were still at an age when enthusiasm cannot keep silence, and had been transported into a life in which not to be known is unendurable, we wrote a letter, signed with both our names, in which we revealed to Elstir, in the two diners seated within a few feet of him, two passionate admirers of his talent, two friends of his great friend Swan, and asked to be allowed to pay our homage to him in person. A waiter undertook to convey this missive to the celebrity. A celebrity, Elstir was perhaps not yet at this period, quite to the extent claimed by the landlord, though he was to reach the height of his fame within a very few years. But he had been one of the first to frequent this restaurant when it was still only a sort of farmhouse, and had brought to it a whole colony of artists who had all, as it happened, migrated elsewhere as soon as the farmyard in which they used to feed in the open air, under a lean-to roof, had become a fashionable centre. Elstir himself had returned to Rivebelle this evening only on account of a temporary absence of his wife from the house which he had taken in the neighbourhood. But great talent, even when its existence is not yet recognised, will inevitably provoke certain phenomena of admiration, such as the landlord had managed to detect in the questions asked by more than one English lady visitor, a thirst for information as to the life led by Elstir, or in the number of letters that he received from abroad. Then the landlord had further remarked that Elstir did not like to be disturbed when he was working, that he would rise in the middle of the night and take a little model down to the water's edge to pose for him nude if the moon was shining, and had told himself that so much labour was not in vain, nor the admiration of the tourists unjustified, when he had, in one of Elstir's pictures, recognised a wooden cross which stood by the roadside as you came into Rivebelle. "It's all right," he would repeat with stupefaction. "There are all the four beams. Oh, he does take a lot of trouble." And he did not know whether a little sunrise over the sea which Elstir had given him might not be worth a fortune. We watched him read our letter, put it in his pocket, finish his dinner, begin to ask for his things, get up to go. And we were so convinced that we had shocked him by our overture that we would now have hoped, as keenly as at first we had dreaded, to make our escape without his noticing us. We did not bear in mind for a single instant a consideration which should nevertheless have seemed to us most important, namely that our enthusiasm for Elstir, on the sincerity of which we should not have allowed the least doubt to be cast, which we could indeed have supported with the evidence of our breathing arrested by expectancy, our desire to do no matter what that was difficult or heroic for the great man, was not, as we imagined it to be, admiration, since neither of us had ever seen anything that he had painted. Our feeling might have as its object the hollow idea of a great artist, but not a body of work which was unknown to us. It was, at the most, admiration in the abstract, the nervous envelope, the sentimental structure of an admiration without content, that is to say, a thing as indissolubly attached to boyhood as are certain organs which have ceased to exist in the adult man. We were still boys. Elstir, meanwhile, was reaching the door when suddenly he turned and came towards us. I was transported by a delicious thrill of terror, such as I could not have felt a few years later, because, while age diminishes our capacity, familiarity with the world has meanwhile destroyed in us any inclination to provoke such strange encounters, to feel that kind of emotion. In the course of the few words that Elstir had come back to say to us, sitting down at our table, he never gave any answer on the several occasions on which I spoke to him of Swan. I began to think that he did not know him. He asked me, nevertheless, to come and see him at his Balbec studio, an invitation which he did not extend to Saint-Loup, and which I had earned, as I might not perhaps from Swan's recommendation, had Elstir been intimate with him, for the part played by disinterested motives is greater than we're inclined to think in people's lives, by a few words which made him think that I was devoted to the arts. He lavished on me a friendliness which was as far above that of Saint Loup as that was above the affability of a mere tradesman. Compared with that of a great artist, the friendliness of a great gentleman, charming as it may be, has the effect of an actor's playing a part, of being feigned. Saint Loup sought to please. Elstir loved to give himself. Everything that he possessed, ideas, work, and the rest for which he counted for far less, he would have given gladly to anyone who could understand him. But, failing society that was endurable, he lived in an isolation with a savagery which fashionable people called pose and ill-breeding. Public authorities a recalcitrant spirit, his neighbours madness, his family selfishness and pride. And no doubt at first he had thought, even in his solitude, with enjoyment that, thanks to his work, he was addressing, in spite of distance, he was giving a loftier idea of himself to those who had misunderstood or hurt him. Perhaps in those days he lived alone not from indifference, but from love of his fellows. And just as I had renounced Gilberte to appear to her again one day in more attractive colours, dedicated his work to certain people as a way of approaching them again, by which, without actually seeing him, they would be made to love him, admire him, talk about him. A renunciation is not always complete from the start. When we decide upon it in our original frame of mind and before it has reacted upon us, whether it be the renunciation of an invalid, a monk, an artist, or a hero. But if he had wished to produce with certain people in his mind, in producing he had lived for himself, remote from the society to which he had become indifferent. The practice of solitude had given him a love for it, as happens with every big thing which we have begun by fearing, because we knew it to be incompatible with smaller things to which we clung, and of which does not so much deprive us as it detaches us from them. Before we experience it, our whole preoccupation is to know to what extent we can reconcile it with certain pleasures, which cease to be pleasures as soon as we have experienced it. Elstir did not stay long talking to us. I made up my mind that I would go to his studio during the next few days. But on the following afternoon, when I had accompanied my grandmother right to the point at which the front ended near the cliffs of Canapville, on our way back, at the foot of one of the little streets which ran down at right angles to the beach, we came upon a girl who, with lowered head like an animal that is being driven reluctant to its stall and carrying golf clubs, was walking in front of a person in authority, in all probability her or her friend's miss, who suggested a portrait of Jeffreys by Hogarth, with a face as red as if her favourite beverage were gin rather than tea, on which a dried smear of tobacco at the corner of her mouth prolonged the curve of a moustache that was grizzled but abundant. The girl who preceded her was like that one of the little band who, beneath a black polo cap, had shown in an inexpressive chubby face a pair of laughing eyes. Now, the girl who was now passing me had also a black polo cap, but she struck me as being even prettier than the other. The line of her nose was straighter, the curve of nostril at its base fuller and more fleshy. Besides, the other had seemed a proud, pale girl. This one, a child well-disciplined and of rosy complexion. And yet, as she was pushing a bicycle just like the others, and was wearing the same reindeer gloves, I concluded that the differences arose perhaps from the angle and circumstances in which I now saw her. For it was hardly likely that there could be at Baalbek a second girl with a face that, when all was said, was so similar and with the same details in her accoutrements. She cast a rapid glance in my direction. For the next few days, when I saw the little band again on the beach, and indeed long afterwards when I knew all the girls who composed it, I could never be absolutely certain that any of them, even she who among them all was most like her, the girl with the bicycle, was indeed the one that I had seen that evening at the end of the front, where a street ran down to the beach, a girl who differed hardly at all, but was still just perceptibly different from her whom I had noticed in the procession. From that moment, whereas for the last few days my mind had been occupied chiefly by the tall one, it was the one with the golf clubs, presumed to be Mademoiselle Simonet, who began once more to absorb my attention. When walking with the others, she would often stop, forcing her friends, who seemed greatly to respect her, to stop also. Thus it is, calling a halt, her eyes sparkling beneath her polo cap, that I see her again today, outlined against the screen which the sea spreads out behind her, and separated from me by a transparent, azure space, the interval of time that has elapsed since then, a first impression, faint and fine in my memory, desired, pursued, then forgotten, then found again, of a face which I have many times since projected upon the cloud of the past, to be able to say to myself of a girl who was actually in my room, "It is she." But it was perhaps yet another, the one with geranium cheeks and green eyes, whom I should have liked most to know. And yet, whichever of them it might be, on any given day that I preferred to see, the others, without her, were sufficient to excite my desire, which, concentrated now chiefly on one, now on another, continued, as on the first day, my confused vision, to combine and blend them, to make of them the little world apart, animated by a life in common, which for that matter they doubtless imagined themselves to form. And I should have penetrated, in becoming a friend of one of them, like a cultivated pagan, or a meticulous Christian going among barbarians, into a rejuvenating society in which reigned health, unconsciousness of others, sensual pleasures, cruelty, unintellectuality, and joy. My grandmother, who had been told of my meeting with Elstir, and rejoiced at the thought of all the intellectual profit that I might derive from his friendship, considered it absurd and none too polite of me not to have gone yet to pay him a visit. But I could think only of the little band, and being uncertain of the hour at which the girls would be passing along the front, I dared not absent myself. My grandmother was astonished, too, at the smartness of my attire, for I had suddenly remembered suits which had been lying all this time at the bottom of my trunk. I put on a different one every day, and had even written to Paris ordering new hats and neckties. It adds a great charm to life in a watering place like Baalbek, if the face of a pretty girl, a vendor of shells, cakes, or flowers, painted in vivid colours on our mind, is regularly from early morning the purpose of each of those leisured, luminous days which we spend upon the beach. They become then, and for that reason, albeit unoccupied by any business, as alert as working days, pointed, magnetized, raised slightly to meet an approaching moment, that in which, while we purchase sand cakes, roses, ammonites, we will delight in seeing upon a feminine face its colours displayed as purely as on a flower. But at least, with these little traffickers, first of all, we can speak to them, which saves us from having to construct with our imagination their aspects other than those which the mere visual perception of them furnishes us, and to recreate their life, magnifying its charm as when we stand before a portrait. Moreover, just because we speak to them, we can learn where and at what time it will be possible to see them again. Now, I had none of these advantages with respect to the little band. Their habits were unknown to me. When on certain days I failed to catch a glimpse of them, not knowing the cause of their absence, I sought to discover whether it was something fixed and regular, if they were to be seen only every other day, or in certain states of the weather, or if there were days on which no one ever saw them. I imagined myself already friends with them, and saying, "But you weren't there the other day." "Weren't we? Oh, no, of course not. That was because it was a Saturday. On Saturdays we don't ever come, because..." If it were only as simple as that, to know that on Black Saturday it was useless to torment oneself that one might range the beach from end to end, sit down outside the pastry cook's and pretend to be nibbling an éclair, poke into the curiosity shop, wait for bathing time, the concert, high tide, sunset, night, all without seeing the longed-for little band. But the fatal day did not perhaps come once a week. It did not perhaps of necessity fall on Saturdays. Perhaps certain atmospheric conditions influenced it, or were entirely unconnected with it. How many observations, patient but not at all serene, must one accumulate of the movements, to all appearance irregular, of those unknown worlds before being able to be sure that one has not allowed oneself to be led astray by mere coincidence, that one's forecasts will not be proved wrong, before one elucidates the certain laws, acquired at the cost of so much painful experience, of that passionate astronomy. Remembering that I had not yet seen them on some particular day of the week, I assured myself that they would not be coming, that it was useless to wait any longer on the beach. And at that very moment I caught sight of them. And yet, on another day, which, so far as I could suppose that there were laws that guided the return of those constellations, must, I had calculated, prove an auspicious day, they did not come. But to this primary uncertainty whether I should see them or not that day, there was added another more disquieting: whether I should ever set eyes on them again. For I had no reason, after all, to know that they were not about to sail for America or return to Paris. This was enough to make me begin to love them. One can feel an attraction towards a particular person, but to release that fount of sorrow, that sense of the irreparable, those agonies which prepare the way for love, there must be, and this is perhaps more than any person can be, the actual object which our passion seeks so anxiously to embrace, the risk of an impossibility. Thus there were acting upon me already those influences which recur in the course of our successive love affairs, which can for that matter be provoked, but then rather in the life of cities, by the thought of little working girls whose half-holiday is we know not on what day, and whom we are afraid of having missed as they came out of the factory, or which at least have recurred in mine. Perhaps they are inseparable from love. Perhaps everything that formed a distinctive feature of our first love attaches itself to those that come after, by recollection, suggestion, habit, and through the successive periods of our life, gives to its different aspects a general character. I seized every pretext for going down to the beach at the hours when I hoped to succeed in finding them there. Having caught sight of them once while we were at luncheon, I now invariably came in late for it, waiting interminably upon the front for them to pass, devoting all the short time that I did spend in the dining room to interrogating with my eyes its azure wall of glass, rising long before the dessert, so as not to miss them should they have gone out at a different hour, and chafing with irritation at my grandmother, when, with unwitting malevolence, she made me stay with her past the hour that seemed to me propitious. I tried to prolong the horizon by setting my chair aslant. If by chance I did catch sight of no matter which of the girls, since they all partook of the same special essence, it was as if I had seen projected before my face, in a shifting, diabolical hallucination, a little of the unfriendly and yet passionately coveted dream, which but a moment ago had existed only, where it lay stagnant for all time, in my brain. I was in love with none of them, loving them all, and yet the possibility of meeting them was in my daily life the sole element of delight, alone made to burgeon in me those high hopes by which every obstacle is surmounted, hopes ending often in fury if I had not seen them. For the moment these girls eclipsed my grandmother in my affection. The longest journey would at once have seemed attractive to me had it been to a place in which they might be found. It was to them that my thoughts comfortably clung when I supposed myself to be thinking of something else or of nothing. But when, even without knowing it, I thought of them, they, more unconsciously still, were for me the mountainous blue undulations of the sea, a troop seen passing in outline against the waves. Our most intensive love for a person is always the love, really, of something else as well. Meanwhile, my grandmother was showing, because I now was keenly interested in golf and lawn tennis, and was letting slip an opportunity of seeing at work and hearing talk an artist whom she knew to be one of the greatest of his time, a disapproval which seemed to me to be based on somewhat narrow views. I had guessed long ago in the Champs-Élysées, and had since established to my own satisfaction, that when we are in love with a woman, we simply project onto her a state of our own soul, that the important thing is, therefore, not the worth of the woman, but the depth of the state, and that the emotions which a young girl of no kind of distinction arouses in us can enable us to bring to the surface of our consciousness some of the most intimate parts of our being, more personal, more remote, more essential than would be reached by the pleasure that we derive from the conversation of a great man, or even from the admiring contemplation of his work. I was to end by complying with my grandmother's wishes, all the more reluctantly in that Elstir lived at some distance from the front in one of the newest of Balbec's avenues. The heat of the day obliged me to take the tramway which passed along the Rue de la Plage, and I made an effort, so as still to believe that I was in the ancient realm of the Cimmerians, in the country, it might be, of King Mark, or upon the site of the forest of Brocéliande, not to see the gimcrack splendour of the buildings that extended on either hand, among which Elstir's villa was perhaps the most sumptuously hideous, in spite of which he had taken it, because of all that there were to be had at Balbec, it was the only one that provided him with a really big studio. It was also with averted eyes that I crossed the garden, which had a lawn, in miniature like any little suburban villa round Paris, a statuette of an amorous gardener, glass balls in which one saw one's distorted reflection, beds of begonias and a little arbour, beneath which rocking chairs were drawn up around an iron table. But after all these preliminaries hallmarked with Philistine ugliness, I took no notice of the chocolate mouldings on the plinths once I was in the studio. I felt perfectly happy, for with the help of all the sketches and studies that surrounded me, I foresaw the possibility of raising myself to a poetical understanding, rich in delights, of many forms which I had not hitherto isolated from the general spectacle of reality. And Elstir's studio appeared to me as the laboratory of a sort of new creation of the world, in which, from the chaos that is all the things we see, he had extracted, by painting them on various rectangles of canvas that were hung everywhere about the room, here a wave of the sea crushing angrily on the sand its lilac foam, there a young man in a suit of white linen leaning upon the rail of a vessel. His jacket and the spattering wave had acquired fresh dignity from the fact that they continued to exist, even although they were deprived of those qualities in which they might be supposed to consist, the wave being no longer able to splash, nor the jacket to clothe anyone. At the moment at which I entered, the creator was just finishing, with the brush which he had in his hand, the form of the sun at its setting. The shutters were closed almost everywhere round the studio, which was fairly cool, and except in one place where daylight laid against the wall, its brilliant but fleeting decoration, dark. There was open only one little rectangular window, embowered in honeysuckle, which, over a strip of garden, gave on an avenue, so that the atmosphere of the greater part of the studio was dusky, transparent, and compact in the mass, but liquid and sparkling at the rifts where the golden clasp of sunlight banded it, like a lump of rock crystal of which one surface already cut and polished, here and there gleams like a mirror with iridescent rays. While Elstir and my request went on painting, I wandered about in the half-light, stopping to examine first one picture, then another. Most of those that covered the walls were not what I should chiefly have liked to see of his work. Paintings in what an English art journal which lay about on the reading-room table in the Grand Hotel called his first and second manners, the mythological manner, and the manner in which he showed signs of Japanese influence, both admirably exemplified, the article said, in the collection of Madame de Guermantes. Naturally enough, what he had in his studio were almost all seascapes done here at Baalbek, but I was able to discern from these that the charm of each of them lay in a sort of metamorphosis of the things represented in it, analogous to what in poetry we call metaphor, and that, if God the Father had created things by naming them, it was by taking away their names, or giving them other names, that Elstir created them anew. The names which denote things correspond invariably to an intellectual notion, alien to our true impressions, and compelling us to eliminate from them everything that is not in keeping with itself. Sometimes in my window in the hotel at Baalbek, in the morning when Françoise undid the fastenings of the curtain that shut out the light, in the evening when I was awaiting until it should be time to go out with Saint-Loup, I had been led by some effect of sunlight to mistake what was only a darker stretch of sea for a distant coastline, or to gaze at a belt of liquid azure without knowing whether it belonged to sea or sky. But presently my reason would re-establish between the elements that distinction which in my first impression I had overlooked. In the same way I used in Paris in my bedroom to hear a dispute, almost a riot in the street below, until I referred back to its cause, a carriage, for instance, that was rattling towards me, this noise, from which I now eliminated the shrill and discordant vociferations which my ear had rarely heard, but which my reason knew that wheels did not produce. But the rare moments in which we see nature as she is with poetic vision, it was from those that Elstir's work was taken. One of his metaphors that occurred most commonly in the seascapes which he had round him was precisely that which, comparing land with sea, suppressed every line of demarcation between them. It was this comparison, tacitly and untiringly repeated on a single canvas, which gave it that multiform and powerful unity, the cause, not always clearly perceived by themselves, of the enthusiasm which Elstir's work aroused in certain collectors. It was, for instance, for a metaphor of this sort, in a picture of the harbour of Calcatuich, a picture which he had finished a few days earlier, and at which I now stood gazing my fill, that Elstir had prepared the mind of the spectator by employing for the little town only marine terms, and urban terms for the sea. Whether its houses concealed a part of the harbour, a dry dock, or perhaps the sea itself came cranking in among the land, as constantly happened on the Baalbek coast, on the other side of the promontory on which the town was built, the roofs were overtopped, as it had been by mill chimneys or church steeples, by masts, which had the effect of making the vessels to which they belonged appear town-bred, built on land, an impression which was strengthened by the sight of other boats moored along the jetty but in such serried ranks that you could see men talking across from one deck to another without being able to distinguish the dividing line, the chink of water between them, so that this fishing fleet seemed less to belong to the water than, for instance, the churches of Kriekebeek, which in the far distance, surrounded by water on every side, because you saw them without seeing the town, in a powdery haze of sunlight and crumbling waves, seemed to be emerging from the water, blown in alabaster or in sea foam, and enclosed in the band of a parti-coloured rainbow to form an unreal, a mystical picture. On the beach in the foreground, the painter had arranged that the eye should discover no fixed boundary, no absolute line of demarcation between earth and ocean. The men who were pushing down their boats into the sea were running as much through the waves as along the sand, which, being wet, reflected their hulls as if they were already in the water. The sea itself did not come up in an even line, but followed the irregularities of the shore, which the perspective of the picture increased still further, so that a ship actually at sea, half hidden by the projecting works of the arsenal, seemed to be sailing across the middle of the town. Women who were gathering shrimps among the rocks had the appearance, because they were surrounded by water, and because of the depression which, after the ring-like barrier of rocks, brought the beach on the side nearest the land down to sea level, of being in a marine grotto overhung by ships and waves, open yet unharmed in the path of a miraculously averted tide. If the whole picture gave this impression of harbours in which the sea entered into the land, in which the land was already subaqueous and the population amphibian, the strength of the marine element was everywhere apparent, and round about the rocks at the mouth of the harbour, where the sea was rough, you felt from the muscular efforts of the fishermen and the obliquity of the boats leaning over at an acute angle, compared with the calm erectness of the warehouse on the harbour, the church, the houses of the town to which some of the figures were returning while others were coming out to fish, that they were riding bareback on the water, as it might be a swift and fiery animal whose rearing, but for their skill, must have unseated them. A party of holiday-makers were putting gaily out to sea in a boat that tossed like a jaunting car on a rough road, their boatman, blithe but attentive also to what he was doing, trimmed the bellying sail, everyone kept in his place, so that the weight should not be all on one side of the boat, which might capsize, and so they went racing over sunlit fields into shadowy places, dashing down into the troughs of waves. It was a fine morning, in spite of the recent storm. Indeed, one could still feel the powerful activities that must first be neutralized in order to attain the easy balance of the boats that lay motionless, enjoying sunshine and breeze, in parts where the sea was so calm that its reflections had almost more solidity and reality than the floating hulls, vaporized by an effect of the sunlight, parts which the perspective of the picture dovetailed in among others. Or rather, you would not have called them other parts of the sea. For between those parts there was as much difference as there was between one of them and the church rising from the water, or the ships behind the town. Your reason then set to work, and made a single element of what was here black beneath a gathering storm, a little farther, all of one colour with the sky and as brightly burnished, and elsewhere so bleached by sunshine, haze and foam, so compact, so terrestrial, so circumscribed with houses, that you thought of some white stone causeway, or of a field of snow, up the surface of which it was quite frightening to see a ship go climbing high and dry, as a carriage climbs dripping from a ford, but which a moment later, when you saw on the raised and broken surface of the solid plain boats drunkenly heaving, you understood, identical in all these different aspects, to be still the sea. Although we're justified in saying that there can be no progress, no discovery in art, but only in the sciences, and that the artist who begins afresh upon his own account and individual effort cannot be either helped or hindered by the efforts of all the others, we must nevertheless admit that insofar as art brings into prominence certain laws, once an industry has taken those laws and vulgarized them, the art that was first in the field loses, in retrospect, a little of its originality. Since Elstir began to paint, we have grown familiar with what are